That's right, Tom. Much of our politics today is a struggle over entrenchment. Both sides strive to bring about change in ways that opponents will find difficult to undo. That's why the stakes of contemporary politics are so high. In his new book, Entrenchment, author Paul Starr examines how changes made at the foundations of society become hard to reverse, yet are sometimes overturned with sweeping impact on the nation. Overcoming aristocratic power was the formative problem for 18th century revolutions, Starr argues, and overcoming slavery was the central problem for early American democracy. Controlling the power of concentrated wealth has been an ongoing struggle in the world's capitalist democracies. The battles continue today in the troubled democracies of our time, with the rise of both oligarchy and populist nationalism, and the danger that illiberal forces will entrench themselves in power. In his incisive and original book, Starr helps us understand both the forces that make change difficult and the forces that make dramatic change possible. In a political culture that's abandoned many traditional norms, and with American politicians on both the left and right challenging foundational ideas, entrenchment illuminates fundamental questions about the origins of our institutions and urgent questions about the future. Paul Starr is a professor of sociology and public affairs at Princeton University, co-founder and founding co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction and the Bancroft Prize in American History. Thank you so much for joining us today, Paul Starr.
I'm delighted to be with you.
Can you talk about why controlling the power of... Welcome, Paul Starr. It's a pleasure to have you on our show today.
Glad to be with you.
Why did you choose to write this book, and why right now?
So this is a book about the foundations of power, and why now? It's a book about the troubles that democracies are experiencing today in the United States and elsewhere, and what the origins are of those problems. And one of the key aspects has to do with inequality in wealth and power, and with the tremendous concentration of wealth that has taken place over the past half century, with most of the gains from economic growth going to people at the top. And this is a perennial issue about justice, and I've tried to, in this book, to take this back really to the period of the founding of our country and even earlier, and try to understand both sides of this. That is, on the one hand, the entrenched power of wealth, but also on the other, the kind of rules that our Constitution gives us that can entrench democratic principles. And so there's a tension here through history and right up to the present.
Right, and so can we talk about those periods of history briefly, and why they inform us as to today's politics and what we're looking at?
Okay, so yeah, it very much depends on what the rules are, and so for example, our Constitution is crucial for maintaining rule of law and freedom and equality and so forth. But our Constitution also protected slavery, and so there were both elements in it. So I begin the story with something that I think very few people are aware of today, and that has to do with systems of inheritance that used to concentrate all wealth in the eldest son. The system is of primogeniture, introduced in England in 1066 with the Norman Conquest, and only finally abolished in the 20th century. Really over a millennium, the system of inheritance in England concentrated wealth in a narrow aristocracy, and that was the basis of power in that country. And this could have been transplanted to the United States. Indeed, the rule of primogeniture was followed in wealthy families in Virginia and elsewhere. But Thomas Jefferson and others saw that rule of primogeniture as one of the things that the Revolution had to overturn. And indeed, at the time of the Revolution and in the years immediately afterwards, states changed their laws of inheritance and really, you know, prevented the emergence in the United States of that kind of landed aristocracy.
And this is one example of how that was overturned and rules worked in our favor. Can you talk also about what happened in terms of slavery and the double-sided coin with entrenchment there?
Yeah. So I look at this as a question of where there was really a kind of entrenched contradiction at the founding of the United States. A contradiction that got expressed in the different development of the free states and the slave states and ultimately the Civil War. And so the European countries that created the biggest system of slavery in the world, Britain and France and the Netherlands and so forth, they didn't actually bring slavery into their home society. They had slavery in their colonies, but not at home. The United States was a different case because slavery was inside. And in effect, that difference became a split between the free states and the slave states. And we actually had really two different societies, two different kinds of economy that developed in the United States in the late 1700s and early 1800s, and they were both expansionary and really aggressive, and it was, in fact, the expansion into the West that ultimately was the source of the conflict that sparked the Civil War. So you can have contradictory systems entrenched in a society. That's I think one of the key things about the Civil War.
Right. And so can you talk about that, the forces that make change difficult on the one hand and the forces that can allow for dramatic change to be possible?
Yeah. So there was obviously a tremendous amount of wealth and power arrayed on the side of slavery, not just the slaveholders themselves, but often the merchants in the North and elsewhere in England and so forth that were connected with slavery, and yet it was overcome. Now, it was partly overcome, really, because of moral and religious movements that disapproved of the inhumanity and humiliation and domination that slavery entailed. We should never underestimate the importance of those moral considerations, but. You know, the other thing is that there was a different kind of economy developing in the North, and that economy consisted of independent farmers and small businessmen. They saw slavery as a threat, and the early development of the Republican Party in the 1850s and 60s came out of these groups that really both morally disapproved of slavery and saw it as a threat. In the late 19th and early 20th century, there emerged monopolies, trusts, combinations of businesses that overwhelmingly threatened small businessmen and workers and consumers. And again, you had movements, thinking now of the populist movement and others, that came together and resulted in the passage of the antitrust laws and other changes that created a more equal playing field, and in some cases broke up those combinations. So that's, you know, it's partly economic, but it also draws on certain ideas, certain principles, certain beliefs that people have about what a just society is, what fairness is, and those. Again, it's crucial not to forget that side of social change. These capitalist democracies accepted a great deal of regulation of business. They became more equal. This is the period when Social Security became established and many other policies that provided greater protection for ordinary people in old age, sickness, and so forth. And And so we were able to see important changes and reforms that put important democratic limits on the capitalist economy. That's the kind of experience that I look back at. Not that we should repeat the tragedies of the world wars or anything, but it's evidence of the capacity for reform, the capacity for adaptation, and the capacity for progress.
Right, and the impact that it can have. It seems rather overwhelming when you look at today's landscape, with the influence of high tech, with the marriage of high tech and government in certain capacities. It could almost seem impossible that we would ever find justice again like that in mass. Do you see ways of that taking place in our society today, and what would they be if you do?
Well, first of all, one of the reasons for studying history is to realize that there were similar problems in other times that seemed equally impossible. This is part of the point of this book, Entrenchment. There are these sources of entrenched wealth and power that at some times seem impossible to overcome, but in fact, there were movements that did overcome them. So now, just coming to the present, you referred to the tech sector. Okay, so if you think about all the optimism in the 1990s as the internet first developed, and people really thought that it was going to lead to so much decentralization, and it was going to break up concentrated power, and now look. You know, now look what's happened. It's the basis for the emergence of these extraordinary monopolies, platform monopolies that control these online platforms, Amazon and Apple and Google and Facebook. And I think can recognize that there was a certain amount of naivete at the beginning of all this. And a failure to realize that, we still need antitrust laws. We still need regulations. We can't just assume that the market is going to take care of everything. And so I'm very gratified now that there's a lot of concern and the beginnings, I think, of effective action to put some limits on the power of these companies.
Yeah, well, and also the idea that our privacy was sort of overnight felt like it kind of got taken right out for us from under us when we weren't quite looking, or maybe I should say when we were looking, too busy looking at our own phones to really understand what was taking place. And now we have this, it's almost become a new normal. Do you ever see us reversing that and getting our privacy back?
Well, it's not going to be easy. I think it's now becoming clear to Americans that we need a whole new set of rules about the uses that companies can make of the information that they are sweeping up from the ordinary communications, the ordinary transactions that are being conducted online. We've entered a new era, which one sociologist calls surveillance capitalism, because we've got all these companies that in their everyday business or our everyday business sweep up all this information. They're effectively conducting surveillance on us, and that information is very valuable to them. It's the basis on which they make extraordinary amounts of money, and there just aren't any limits on what they can do with it.
So, given your knowledge, historical knowledge of entrenchment, how do we unentrench ourselves from this?
well, I think first of all, let's consider the antitrust laws. Facebook should not have been allowed to buy both Instagram and WhatsApp, so that it effectively controls its competitors. There should have been more aggressive enforcement, limiting the kinds of acquisitions that Apple and Google and Amazon and so forth can make. And they now have such a dominant position that it's very difficult for a lot of new ventures to make any headway. So that's one part of it. And then, I think we need to consider new regulations. I'm not just, making this up. I mean, there is a lot of activity taking place in Washington. Interestingly enough, this is coming from both parties, and it's coming, I think, from a wide variety of groups in American society. So I think there is the energy there. There isn't yet, I think, a very clear notion about what needs to be done, but it's the beginning stage, I think, of effective action limiting this new source of concentrated wealth and power.
You're in touch with the younger generation. Do you really see them as being concerned about this?
Well, I think this is just an emerging concern right now. And I really can't say, that it's a concern more for younger people or for older people. I'm not sure, but I think it's a concern for the future. And therefore, it ought to be a concern of younger people, especially because of the kind of power and domination that is now being concentrated in these companies. I mean, let's just take the most obvious example. 2 billion people around the world belong to Facebook, and that is a company controlled entirely by one man. It's a kind of corporate monarchy. And although Mark Zuckerberg will refer to it as a community, it's not much of a community. It's what he decides sets the rules. So that's people ought to be concerned about it, even if they haven't yet found out how worrisome this is.
What would be the difference between Trump's election the first round and electing him on a second round?
Most of what Trump has done during his first term can probably be reversed or offset. But if Donald Trump has a second term, a full 8 years, I think the effects are going to be much harder to undo. And what I have in mind are really three different things. I mean, first, the most obvious, the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court now has a 5-4 conservative majority. With another 4 years, Trump will probably be able to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg and possibly Stephen Breyer. And at that point, the court would have a 7-2 majority. It would be, I think, a much more radically right-wing court, and I think that majority would last for a long time to come. It would greatly limit what any, what any Democratic administration could do that followed Trump. Now, a second thing, which I think is really, just as important, perhaps more important, has to do with climate change. If the United States does nothing about reducing carbon emissions until the mid to late 2020s, it's going to be much more difficult. It's going to be more costly, more politically difficult to get anything done because the rate of decarbonization, the rate at which we would need to reduce carbon emissions, would be much higher than it is now. That has really terrible implications for the future. And then the third thing that I talk about has to do with America's international alliances and relations, and particularly with nuclear weapons. So under Trump, those alliances have been destabilized. Our allies don't know for sure whether the United States would come to their defense. Trump has unilaterally withdrawn from arms control treaties, and there is evidence of a new nuclear arms race. And again, I think with only one term, this can be held back, it can be stopped, it can be changed. But with a full 8 years, I worry very greatly about the long-term implications of it, whether once this kind of thing starts going, it's very, very hard to stop. So those are all concerns about entrenchment, about the entrenchment of a right-wing majority on the Supreme Court, about the entrenchment of climate policies that are really enormously destructive, and then finally about international relations. So that's where my concerns are. The right-wing populace and the wealthy have a lot in common. They're both trying to protect long dominant interests, social interests, and economic interests, and they have made an alliance of convenience, Donald Trump is the embodies that the oligarch is populist.
But why is it that people can't see that?
Well, it depends what interests they care about more. And I think if you take a look at the tax legislation that Trump signed, that legislation overwhelmingly provides benefits to the most wealthy, to the biggest corporations in the country, and yet you have a lot of working people who voted for it, and it's not working for them. There's no consistency there. If you're more worried about immigrants, maybe that's maybe you put that as a higher concern. There are a lot of things happening simultaneously. There's this continuing backlash against all the changes that have taken place in this country over the last several decades. Backlash against African Americans. Backlash against women. And the backlash isn't new, but I think what is new is the panic among many conservative whites about the political implications of all these social trends with the growth of immigrants and a fear that things are spinning out of control, that they're losing the power that they once had, that is the conservative whites once had socially and culturally as well as politically, and I think it's that panic that has driven them into the arms of Donald Trump.
So, and when it comes to the Constitution, do you see it being a saving grace for us in today's time, just as it has been in other periods of history that you profile in your book?
I do place a lot of value in the Constitution, but of course it does depend on the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Constitution. And one of the things that concerns me, as I just said, is the potential for a right-wing majority on the court to take the Constitution in a direction which I think would be very unfortunate from the standpoint of the interests in equality and liberty that we have.
Where would you place the hope for the future?
The hope has to be with the new generation, with young people who I think are moving in a more progressive direction, and that's the next America.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Even against all odds in that time of history, just as we might feel against the odds in our own.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Paul Starr. It's been a pleasure chatting with you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.